Very good. Well, hello, everybody, and I hope you're having a nice Sunday afternoon, and I am delighted that you have chosen to spend the afternoon in this, in the beginning of this course on the totalitarians, and welcome, it's a really interesting thing, the way the Mises Academy operates. It's a totally free market approach to education, and I should mention at the outset that that Danny Sanchez has done a wonderful job. He's worked on this for quite a while now, and he's really gotten things sort of smoothed out and really worked up so that it's a great system. And I want to thank him publicly. And I'll be thanking you more than once. But anyway, thank you, Danny. This is a lot of work, and you do it well. So my name, as I say, is Hunt Tooley, and what I want to talk about is during this course, and what I want you to think about, is all to think about, is the totalitarians. Just a couple of slides here. I will. Each time, I think James has put the presentation probably already in a place where you can get at it and see it directly, or see it on your own PowerPoint or something like that on your own computer, or you can watch it here, obviously. And if you don't have it, just just work with us and we'll send it to you. That's no problem at all. So, surrounded by red, the totalitarians, and I think that's an appropriate color. I thought I would create an 8 weeks type plan, because all the totalitarians seem to be always attached to these, these years-long plans. Hitler had his four-year plan, Stalin had his first, second, third, fourth, five-year plans, and all the rest of them have something like that. So I thought it would only be appropriate that we open this up with not a schedule, but an 8 weeks plan, and that there will be requirements of you. Not to say, oops, I went too far. Not to say that there will be quotas. Or deadly consequences if you don't keep up, but there's enough reading. There might be some sort of consequences for you, or pangs of conscience, or something like that. It works out to around 100 pages reading each week, and we get 1 week off, and that's Easter, and then maybe another. Let me just ask about that when we get a few more people in. It's about that much reading. A lot of it's pretty dense reading. A lot of it's not quite as dense, but it's all of it interesting, I think, and all of it somewhat depressing, but also in a way kind of exciting to learn about at first hand with some primary documents and a lot of contemporary explanations by people, and a lot of contemporary sort of, you might say, commentaries by folks who were watching all this happen in the 20s and 30s and 40s. So that's a very interesting topic. Of course, the Mises' book, Omnipotent Government, is at the forefront of all this. I have a copy here. It's a newer copy. The one put out by the Mises, not by the Mises Institute, but by Libertarian Press. It's the copy that the Institute sells, I believe. Well, it is an Institute book. And so that's the book. You can get it in hard copy if you like, or you can read it in any of the available forms in the links provided. And we'll spend roughly a quarter of our time working our way through this great analysis of total government by Ludwig von Mises, written actually during the wartime. We'll bring in some other Misesian writings, a few other writings by anti-collectivist authors of various kinds, and then some contemporary material that is primary documents, reading what Mussolini said, reading what Hitler said, and so forth. And we'll spend a good bit of time comparing these total regimes. And so I think this is going to be an exciting few weeks. Let me break that kind of a concentration on the course material and just ask this. I think we only have eight. Whoops, we lost an attendee. That's bad sign if we lost one already. I mean, for the rest of you, it gets better from here on out, if that helps in any way. But one thing I'd like to ask, and I guess there are pretty few people here, but is anybody here planning to attend the Austin Scholars Conference? I just thought there might be some overlap, and we do happen to be meeting the day after the conference, which, if you know anything about Auburn, is going to be a travel day pretty much no matter what. And so I just thought I would get a sort of show of hands. I know you can't show me your hands, but you can use your hands and type. And just let me know if anybody is, it might be all of you are planning to go. Well, there's no conflict for me, no. So far so good. I mean, everybody let me know if you can. I don't see any. Anymore, I haven't looked into it. Nope. I would have been in Kansas City. I think it looks like no, but I mean, we got a lot of other people. I'm not sure why they haven't joined in, but in any case, but it looks like it might not be a problem. And so we can, let's just for now say that we will meet on March 11th. That's the day. I mean, it's otherwise we just skip that week and extend the course another week. And so we can, Danny and I had talked about this, and this is the point at which I'm checking all this out. So somebody explains why there's so few. It's kind of hard to get signed in for the first time. Well, I'm doing a little bit of stalling here, but some housekeeping things can get done. Actually, you know, on the list, I have seen. I didn't get a chance to study it in great detail and do much memorizing or anything, but I did see people from all kinds of different time zones and continents, and that's always very interesting in these Mises courses. I think the other course I did, the one on inflation, we had somebody from Romania and somebody from Asia. We had somebody from Hawaii. So we had a lot of different time zones in that one, too. And I see there's some crossover here. I know Jeff Lescovar is back. Hello, Jeff. How you doing? And there may be a couple more. As I say, I didn't get a chance to pore over that list very much. But in any case, the student body is from all kinds of places. Yeah, yes, Lee, I'm about to introduce myself, and I thought I would give it just one more second before I do that. Let me say at the outset, we'll be sending this information out and putting it on the page and everything. If you are interested in taking the course for a grade so that you read the material along with me and you get some kind of grade back, there is a kind of weekly assignment that I've set up that you can do, and you are welcome to do that, and I will grade it myself and put some marks on it and get it back to you, give you a sense of your reading comprehension of these things and the kind of thought that you're doing about it. And then at the end, there's a kind of eight short thing. These are about a page long. It's not really extensive. Careful work, but fairly concise work. And at the end, then you send to me an answer to a question, which I'll, it's not really a test, it's just more of a thought question in which you kind of pull some things together. Also about a page, not a long paper. So short papers, short and sweet and to the point, and that's the way to get a grade for this course. Okay, to the question, am I a professor somewhere? Well, I am a professor at Austin College, and that's not in Austin, Texas, but in Sherman, Texas. We have a small liberal arts college that predated the University of Texas as it's set up in Austin, although Austin College is named after Stephen F. Austin, who was the father of Texas. And so we do indeed have a college that's existed since the 1840s, and I've taught here for about 20 years. My academic specialty is, I guess you might say, war, revolution, and peace in 20th century Europe. And my main areas in which I've published are in those areas, but mainly in Central Europe. I'm more of a German historian than a Russian historian, though I also teach Russian history at our college, and I've done that for 20 years also. I had some very fine mentors at the University of Virginia in Slavic and Eastern European history, so I have some training in that and some publishing in that. So this is all this material in this course is kind of my bailiwick in terms of what I teach and what I write about, what I've written about. So that's what I am a professor of. Let's continue then and just move along. I just wanted to point out a couple of great precursors, or maybe you'd say one postcursor and one precursor of the course up there. The one on the right is Ludendorff, and the one on the left, well, you'll have to guess who that is. So I'd like to start the material of the course today with a deep historical rundown. We won't get to Hitler per se today. We won't get to Stalin today, but we will get to Lenin. So it's from, let's say, beginning of time until about 1900, and that's not much of a task to cover. But these older roots of totalitarianism are really, really important in understanding the modern phenomenon, and the ways in which the modern phenomenon fits into some historical patterns, but also the ways in which the modern version of total government has some very distinct differences. One more administrative thing. I do want to say that before the end of this, at the end of this class, I'm going to talk for a little bit more of this class than I usually be talking. I'm going to try to devote about half and half of our time together to kind of set lecture things that I want to say, and then your answer responses to your questions. So we kind of have a class discussion atmosphere, at least a question and answer atmosphere. So let's think now about the distant background in terms of totalitarian government. You know, we have a lot of examples in the ancient world of governments that were certainly authoritarian, often really draconian. I've got a picture here, Ramses II, and you know, there's a lot of modern things about Ramses II. He was running an Egyptian empire. The authoritarian nature of his regime fed off the empire, and that's really important in the 20th century. We're looking at a colossal a piece of sculpture, in other words, a colossus or a huge statue. that the ancient world used oftentimes, like modern totalitarians, to kind of give the impression that they were colossal human beings and embody some kind of abstract notion of their rule. On the other hand, you know, what's missing with Ramses II or Sargon I or the Assyrian kings, Ashurbanipal, and any of those Mesopotamian kings, or if we slip over and look at the earliest of the Chinese emperors and so forth, what is really missing is in a sense, the modern technology, especially technology of communications. In a way, all of these regimes had to rely on religion to kind of hold things together. This, you may remember Hammurabi's law code and the extent to which Hammurabi uses the old Babylonian god to to justify obedience, to enforce obedience. But on the other hand, putting out these laws was this, you know, to some extent, the extent of it. And people who lived up in the mountains where armies just couldn't go, so that would be communications and transportation. Then these things made for a much lower stakes kind of terroristic government, although plenty of these governments were, in fact, terroristic. So there's a tradition of total governments. You see some of these traditions being reflected in the Romans, but I won't discuss the Romans too much. In a way, the Romans were, they were enough devoted to the contractual nature of society, the law is a contract, that even after the fall of the empire, there was always that kind of notion that somewhere, somehow, people had rights, and that individuals, at least certain individuals, existed in such a fashion that they had a kind of autonomy, even when they're being persecuted or ethnically cleansed or whatever that was. So there are some problems with those older regimes. Now, some folks had ideas about how to make those regimes more total, and I think we should mention Plato's Republic. I think we should mention the Spartans. Plato, in that great Socratic book, The Republic, wrote that, as everybody knows, I'm sure you've heard about philosopher kings, but he wrote, philosophers must become kings, or those now called kings must genuinely and adequately philosophize. And so he creates a kind of state in which the rulers are the people who have come up out of the cave and who have seen the light and who understand all the vast possibilities of society, et cetera, et cetera. Not that this existed anywhere, though it's certainly true that the Spartan city-state, the Spartan polis and its surrounding areas in the south of the Greek archipelago, it's certainly true that these Spartans approximated something like a kind of totally grasping state, a state that demanded that all men, all free men, eat together, play together, train with their weapons together, all these kinds of things that the kings and council made decisions and people had to follow those, et cetera, et cetera. But with the Greeks especially, there's always a chance that the individual would emerge. And, you know, some philosophers, Karl Popper, for example, took Plato very seriously. Some philosophers think that it could even be a kind of backhanded way of saying something else. So we're not on firm ground here because we don't know really enough about some of these conditions to know everything in ancient times, but certainly these ideas were around. Now, if we move on to the Middle Ages, pardon me, we really see that there's no chance of totalitarianism here. I mean, first of all, the fundamental technological conditions of the whole setup were just simply missing. In the Middle Ages, people were really limited to their little area. Travelers were few and far between, especially in the early Middle Ages, Middle Ages, after the horse revolution of the 900s and 1000s, people began to move a little farther, and then shipping started around the middle of the 1100s and 12, and all that. So it's certainly true that people began to move, but in the depth of the Middle Ages, up through 1000, certainly, you don't have any kind of communication except very slow, sort of foot-drawn communication, and you don't have much in the way of transportation either. So those conditions were absent. Also, the way that this whole system was set up, that is to say, from the standpoint of individual contracts among nobles, noblemen, this is also a factor here. The Middle Ages in Europe actually was a time of extreme decentralization of power. And strangely, for all the bad reputation, the bad publicity the Middle Ages has gotten in political terms, as, you know, the sway of the robber barons and all that, at least these barons recognized rights, even if sometimes in the breach of those rights. Even peasants, we know from all kinds of records in the Middle Ages, even peasants often stopped to demand their rights of the nobility. So it's a society in which there was a kind of contractual relationship or element that was really, really crucial, and especially the relationship between the nobles who had these absolutely contractual feudal connections, one liege to the next lord, that lord as liege to the next lord, and so forth. And that was the texture of feudalism. That's highly oversimplified, but we're just kind of making our way quickly through this. So I see a question here. Are you saying that totalitarianism is dependent on technology? In part, yes, not totally, and I'll get to the other part in a minute. But yeah, that's a point that I'm going to develop more. So the Middle Ages no go, but at the end of the Middle Ages, a number of things happened to create the thinking about a new kind of entity on the face of the earth, not a kingdom, not a republic, not a duchy, not a realm, but rather a state. And that's a very specific kind of thing. Historians and philosophers, political philosophers, economists, have worked over this problem for a very long time. This is not any radical Misesian thinking that the state, as we know it, emerged, and it emerged from whole cloth, basically, in the 1400s, 1500s, perhaps a little bit earlier in some places. But the conception of the state that Machiavelli talked about was a very new concept, and he took ideas from around him. He took ideas from observing the Ottoman Empire. He took ideas from history. He took ideas from what the Spanish monarchy was doing. And he rolled those ideas into one kind of philosophy of the state that was not so much an instructional manual as an observation of what the successful creators of the actual political creators of the state were doing. These political creators, we historians call the new monarchs, And when we say new monarchs, we mean this group of new rulers, most of them princes of one kind or another. Not, that's not in every case, but usually princes, dukes, margraves, whatever, sometimes kings, these princes who laid claim to sovereignty. They laid claim to a new kind of independence. They tried to strip themselves, as Machiavelli very clearly saw, of the interference of international organizations, for example, like the church, of subnational organizations like the nobility and their independent little fiefdoms that existed everywhere. And so Machiavelli was concerned that the new state, the sovereign, like a ship, he said. So it's like a ship sailing out on the sea. It's all independent. You can't run out of bread. You can't run down to the bakery because you're surrounded by water. So Machiavelli envisioned each of the new kinds of countries, and the country that he was pushing, of course, was to be a country called Italy, though it didn't exist yet, but he was pushing for the unification of the Italian peninsula and the emergence of a new kind of state there. But it's supposed to be independent, sovereign, and those entities that interfere with that, then Machiavelli said those things have to be done away with. You have to either destroy those or control them. So that, for example, when he says in his instructions for the prince, when you invade a certain area and there's an old nobility or an old rulership or the old management has lost power, you've just got to kill them all. You've just got to kill every last one of them, because if you don't, they'll come back at you. So in this sense, Machiavelli, in creating the state, lays out a lot of the sort of basics, the fundamentals of cruelty, of the claims of the state to every part and parcel of what's in it. Before Machiavelli, for example, nobles considered themselves lords in their own castle and would never have considered letting an outside force, a king or somebody else, some kind of uber king or emperor or something, actually collect taxes from their peasants. But Machiavelli says this is exactly what we have to do, because those princes are armed and they're good at what they do. They're knights. And what we have to do as centralizers is to build up a standing army that with which we can overwhelm them. Well, standing armies were really a rarity, and they cost more than any other human activity at that time. And so Machiavelli's suggestions necessitated big armies of tax collectors who could go out and not just tax the lands of the particular prince who was attempting to take over, but also the lands of all the other nobles. So this involved in a lot of conflict. It involved what we would call civil wars. It involved princes standing up for their rights, the state working against those. And to tell you the truth, what decided the issue in brief was the canon, because it was at this period of time that the canon was developed in European history from the 1300s on. By the late 1400s, it was a usable tool on the battlefield and proven so in a number of places. Constantinople fell in 1453 because the Turks had kidnapped Hungarian cannon makers and brought them to Constantinople to blow holes in the wall. So there's a big correspondence, and you see it works like this. To support the R&D that would be necessary for all the foundries and the mining and all the individual things that went into making the cannon, then or to pay foundry owners and so forth who were just selling to all comers, arms manufacturers, then it required in the 1500s, it required enormous stocks of money to and wealth to pay for that. So it got to be the case that only the new state could collect enough money to support really an artillery establishment. And so the cannon is also linked, and here again, technology. All these things are very, very important, and technology is clearly linked in this way, the cannon especially, with the rise of the new state. And again, you have this kind of you have another kind of totality invented just with the rise of the state. There was therefore massive rise in taxes. Really, the records that we have in this period are interestingly complete for many places. And you just go from one to the other. In Catalonia, they rise by 12 or 15, a factor of 12 or 15. In France, taxes are 10 times higher for peasants in some cases. And so there were many peasant revolts, tax revolts, and also there were revolts by the noblemen attempting to continue to keep their homes. So it's a very, very unstable period in terms of wars and rumors of wars and civil wars and peasant wars and noble uprisings and all of that. There's a reason that the 1500s become then the century of brutality, because it's the state that comes into existence is productive of brutality in these ways. In other words, it brings war, it causes more people to go more different places and spread disease, and it causes more crops to fail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a big part of this whole scene. So the state was born amid war, and we're going to see at the end of today's lecture that war is the necessary condition, really. Another thing, and I need to say this at the very outset, another thing that comes along, we'll follow this theme too, another thing that is important at the very founding, and you would expect this from the extreme needs of these new monarchs to have money, and that is the manipulation of banking. The Renaissance in the 1300s, 1400s had really invented modern banking. We discussed this at quite some length in our inflation course a year or so ago, or a couple of years ago, nearly now, the whole creation of the new state was accompanied by manipulation of banking, oftentimes the takeover of banking, the stranglehold of the new monarchs on the a medium of exchange, whatever it happened to be. So, for example, the great debasement of Henry VIII when he debased all the coinage. Inflated the currency. Remember, Henry VIII also needed funds. He was in such a need of funds to create royal armies and especially a royal navy, considering England's position. This was just as essential as the army. And to create that navy, not only the Great Debasement, but every other form of kind of confiscation, greater taxation, and then, biggest of all, the expropriation of all the church lands by simply in the act of supremacy in 1534, in which he took over all the properties of the Catholic Church and the nominal headship of it and all of that. So the English Reformation, whatever else it is, and it's many other things, but the English Reformation is certainly a part of this whole creation of the new state. Henry very nicely got control of the church, took its money, closed down all the orphanages, and when the Roman Catholic monks wouldn't leave, he just burned the monasteries and drove them away and so forth. And so he carries out a dissolution of what you might call the safety net of medieval England that was just spectacular in its far-reaching and in negative consequences. So it's no wonder that in this period of time of such dislocation, and we'll start moving through these slides a little bit faster now. It's no wonder that there's a whole lot of thinking about utopias. Thomas More wrote his book Utopia, which means nowhere, by which he meant that this is something that might exist, and it's it's about a kind of widespread communism, an early attempt to kind of look at what it would be like if we set up a had everything in common and didn't have competition and so forth. But there were folks who wanted to institute real utopias. More than one of the Protestant sects that emerged from the Reformation had had a kind of utopian or millenarian vision to them. For example, the Anabaptists, I left off the close quotes there, didn't I? The Anabaptists and the new Zion that they set up in the German city of Münster, the north central German city, in 1533, into 1532. Well, those Anabaptists quite literally said, well, we're going to set up a total regime that is run by a theocracy, and we will form the theocracy here. They declared that all property was common, and since women were regarded as property by these folks, then they said, well, all women are in common too. So they didn't say, well, we're gonna just pass all women around. They said that you, as fast as you can get a wife, she has to accept you. In other words, if you have some if you have some attraction to a woman, then marry her, and if you have some attraction to another woman, then marry her too, because it's holding everything in common, including women as property. They did a lot of killing. They did a lot of execution. They set up a regime that was completely radical for the time, and the rulers, the old ruler, came back with, assisted by all kinds of other forces, German state forces. Germany wasn't one country in those days; it was the Holy Roman Empire, about which a little bit more later. But they were all, and the city was conquered, and all that, and they were all killed and tortured to death, et cetera, et cetera. You know what? It's also no accident that at this time the great opponent of, one of numerous great opponents to all these developments of the utopian state and the state itself came about. One of the most important was a person who, it now occurs to me, I should have written his name down. His name was Etienne de la Boétie. And he's the Mises Institute sells a copy of his book on voluntary servitude, with a foreword by Murray Rothbard. That's a brilliant book. Oh, thanks. Danny wrote that down there. He spelled it quite correctly. So thank you. So I don't have to spell it out. Thanks. And this book, I recommend it highly. It's one of the earliest earlier libertarian views of the events that happened. But in a way, these utopians, Boétie was a radical. I mean, it was a century that drove people to kind of radical thinking. And Martin Luther is one, and the creation of the Counter-Reformation or the Catholic Reformation, and emergence of the Jesuits. I mean, it's a kind of a radical a period where these things kind of shook themselves out. Well, there was war and brutality, et cetera, et cetera, that formed a backdrop to these new monarchs. And the next, that lasts for about three or four generations. I'd say to the new monarchs, we'd call that the people who wanted the centralized power but didn't quite get there, for three or four generations. And so it's the generation of Ferdinand and Isabella and Carlos the Fifth in Spain. It's Francois and the Valois kings in the last Valois kings of France. It's Henry the Eighth, the whole Tudor family in England. These we call new monarchs. But we move forward into the 1600s, into the 17th century, then we see a new thing that comes up, and we have to discuss this. We have to distinguish this new phenomenon, absolutism, from totalitarianism, if we want to use those terms correctly, and if we want to understand the 20th century version of all this. Absolutism was a continuation for sure, but it's a kind of triumphal part of this process. If the new monarchs fought tooth and nail, if Henry VIII fought tooth and nail to solidify the state, to follow the roadmap of Machiavelli, so to speak, then it was folks like this guy in front of us, Louis XIV, who really stood on the shoulders of those new monarchs and solidified power. So where his predecessors, including his father, Louis XIII, and all the rest of the French kings had fought like mad against the nobles rising up and demanding their rights and the creation of civil wars and so forth. Well, Louis XIV could take advantage of that, put down just a few revolts, build a big palace at Versailles, and the brother of C.S. Lewis was a great British historian and wrote a book about Louis XIV called The Splendid Century. And he said what he built at Versailles was a stage for absolutism. It was a place that was totally full of order. Everything's in its right place. Even the bushes are trimmed to be like marching soldiers in rank and file. And it's a place where the nobility was brought to tame them down, to make them toadies of the king, to make that the main center of power. No longer was their real center of power back home on the farms, the manors that they owned. It was in the center of the country, and Louis XIV got to put them all in a kind of rank and file system and distribute his largesse accordingly. So Versailles itself, the palace outside of Paris, was a stage for absolutism. Okay, the characteristics of this absolutism, they look like another stage in the development of the state. All the absolutists claimed divine right. They all said they were the choice of God, that they themselves had been chosen by God to rule, and therefore, in theory, they had absolute power to do anything to anybody. They had absolute power to rule the country. If God had absolute power to rule the universe, then they had absolute power to enforce his commands, at least the commands he gave them. But on the other hand, many of these kings would not have, really did limit their ideas to what they thought might potentially be the commandments of God to people. And they had advisors to work that out for them. And so in some places they had more demands than others, but there really was, in a sense, a limitation on the king. And again, you have this technology problem, because their transportation is way better than in the Middle Ages. Communications are way better than the Middle Ages. But you know, it's still not, you think about it, what we think about when we think about modern totalitarians is those East German Stasi cameras and listening devices in every single room from 1960 on. So there's nothing like that. There's no Orwellian aspect to this at all. And to tell you the truth, the kings themselves did feel limited in a kind of religious or moral sense. So although they did dastardly things and threw all kinds of innocent people in jail and robbed and on a massive scale and collected taxes and all that, still, there's not this sense of real absolute actual power. Now, they did, in fact, centralize madly, and many of them tore up the old states within their realms in order to reconstruct those states along Machiavellian lines. In other words, destroy the memory of anybody of independence. That's the way Machiavelli would have it. they all adopted some form of mercantilism, which was the economic equivalent to I'm going to switch back to the screen and make sure I'm still on the screen here. Sorry. Okay. Well, I still am. I haven't moved. That's lucky. The mercantilism was a kind of total economic intervention that was the rule in most European states and in the European empires for really 300 years. That's the thing that the American Revolution was fought against. That's the thing that Adam Smith was fighting against. That's the this is the mercantilist system is the economics of absolute the absolute monarchies in Europe. So there was control of prices, control of wages. There were tariffs. They abounded. The system was so complicated. It was all based on the idea that a country has to be ready to go to war at any time, and if it doesn't have the supplies, then those should, you need to conquer some place to get those supplies. So there's also an expansive foreign policy that's part of this. All of these divine right kings continued the disruption of all the old loyalties, including church, including region, and all those kinds of things. But I'll emphasize again, these were not totalitarians. A couple of developments in England point for totality, and I'll mention these briefly, but they're important backgrounds to the rise of totalitarianism, and that is the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who is a contemporary of the winner of the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell. Hobbes was one of the first thinkers in the Age of Reason to kind of go back to rationally to the kind of original state of nature to really connect with some kind of political theory or to derive the original origins of government, the original right of government to rule, etc. And Hobbes was, and he's the one on the left, of course, Hobbes was a guy who said, well, in the original version, free people lived in a horrific kind of troglodyte world, war of all against all, everybody lived in a cave, and in this world, this spark of reason that was in the human beings, although they were kind of troglodytish, that eventually this spark of reason led them together and that they appointed government and that they then basically transferred all their rights to the government to protect them. So it's a system of security, and in that system, Hobbes reasoned by pure rationality. I mean, this philosophy so far would be welcomed by absolutists, but many of them were distrustful of it because of the next part, which was that the harsher, the better. If you put people into jail unjustly, if you torture folks without any reason, if you raise their taxes all the time, Hobbes said, that's the way to do it. You know, any way you can terrorize your population, that means that the more effective will be the security of the country. So, and again, all of this leads to arguments and you know, in a way, thank goodness for Hobbes, because it led to John Locke, who contradicted all this and used the same kind of rationalistic approach to derive a very different story. Hobbes's contemporary, Oliver Cromwell, was the Puritan leader who it came basically to control the parliamentarian forces against King Charles I. Won against King Charles I in 1649 or 1648, and then chopped off his head in 1649. Then Cromwell ruled as Lord Protector of what they call no longer the Kingdom of England, but rather the Commonwealth. And Cromwell was, in a sense, a kind of living actor who carried out many of the aspects of the absolutist, much of the advice of Hobbes. But what he puts to it is not, it is that he backs it up with an ideology, a kind of early Puritan sense that if you're doing God's will as a theocrat, then you need to really kick people around. And Oliver Cromwell's rules for those in England, I mean, he's famous for having shut down the pubs and the theaters or limited the pubs and shut down the theaters. He's famous for having run a very tight, strict ship, and having done many of the things the absolutists did, but his basis was not that so much that God had chosen to give him power, but rather that the Puritans were running a theocracy and that had a kind of absolutist direction. Well, both of these ideas, as you see, are very much relative to modern totalitarianism. I mean, one thing I'm going to conclude about totalitarianism today is, as we approach the end of the lecture, is that that really it's there are a lot of ideas that go into it. There's some technology that goes into it. There's some other things that go into it. So it's not as it's not just a simply defined kind of phenomenon. Well, if we scroll forward a century to the French Revolution, then I think we have the introduction of the first real wannabe totalitarian regime, and that comes in the midst of the French Revolution in the year 1793 and early 1794. The introduction of what they called the Terror, the introduction of the guillotine as an instrument of mass executions. The whole thing run by the man to the left of the title there, Maximilian Robespierre. And Robespierre himself, he makes great steps forward. We're talking about great being the development of totalitarianism. He's a man who considers himself an abstract kind of total ruler. He considers himself the voice of virtue, and also the voice of the population. In a way, he's relying on some of the wacky ideas of Rousseau about what we call the voice of the people, or the will of the people, and he translates that into a kind of narcissistic, inflated view, messianic view of himself as the voice of all the people. And so this spiffed up aristocratic looking attorney here that you see in the painting then became the hero of the masses, at least in his own mind. So he creates this revolution, and his forebears, Danton and many others, had already created many of the kind of propagandistic elements of totalitarian societies. The total destruction of, not just of old classes and of old rulers, but the total destruction of old customs. The French Revolution decided for propaganda purposes that it would destroy the old calendar, for example, create a whole new calendar. Religion was run out of Dodge, and the churches were changed into granaries and military depots, etc. All the old was washed away, or was to be washed away, with the blood from the guillotines, not just in Paris, but all over France and the other executions. And hundreds of thousands were executed in the Terror. But eventually, some of Robespierre's friends, he killed so many of his rivals within this leftish totalitarian regime that they got cold feet, thinking that maybe they themselves would be guillotined. And so they teamed up on him and guillotined him in the summer of 1794. So the revolution then slurred a little bit in a different direction, but that totalitarian thinking was was pretty clear. It spawned other kinds of, you might say, ideologies, more than one. For example, the first really, truly communist thinker, Gracchus Babeuf, from modern Europe, was participant in this revolution, tried to take over the government in 1796. There are many other radicals who take, basically, who think that Robespierre was just not hard enough in his terror in the country. So we have several of those. We'll see one in just a moment. In fact, we're looking at him here. He's on the left. Henri de Saint-Simon, Henri Henry. He's the one on the left. Marx is in the center. And Auguste Comte is on the right. And so I'm calling these guys the crucial 19th century nexus. Here's how this little story goes, and I'm not gonna delve into this subject at length. We'll be talking, as we talk next week, about omnipotent government. We'll be talking about Marx at length, and we'll have the thoughts and commentary of Mises on the subject, and so we'll talk about that then. But I do want to just put this little group into a kind of narrative order. On the left, Saint-Simon, well, they're all on the left here, but I mean physically on the page. That's a pretty good joke, I think. I mean, I haven't told many jokes today. There'll be some jokes, but it's not a jokey subject, you know. That's the problem. I mean, how can you make that many jokes? Although, it's also the case, you know, there's a really good book about humor in totalitarian societies. Strangely put together by an American political scientist and an Israeli political scientist in the 1980s. It's very interesting how in our totalitarian societies, the jokes have come fast and thick. In fact, these two political scientists who put together this joke book 20 or 30 years ago pointed out that it's precisely in those cases that you need to joke the most, because you know, you don't have any power, and that gives you at least a sense of some kind of power. I'll bring a couple of jokes in before the end. We'll have dueling totalitarian jokes. Okay, the person on the left is Henri de Saint-Simon, and he's a participant in the French Revolution, was joined in the radical side, actually the American Revolution too. He fought at the Battle of Yorktown on the American side, went back to France, was enthusiastic about the revolution, joined the radicals, got involved in some financial speculation, and got thrown in prison on, well, trumped up charges of being an aristocrat, which he was, but not all aristocrats were guillotined, and frankly not even a majority of those guillotined were aristocrats. So he was in jail expecting to have his head chopped off any day. He survived. He became a clerk in a pawn shop. And then he began to read and write. And he wrote a number of books that all had to do with great grand theories of organizing modern life. One of those, maybe the most important for our purposes, was the book The Organizer. Can I say it in French? L'Organisateur. And The Organizer, written in 1814, was a book in which he essentially rolled out his idea of technocracy as the way of modern life. And this is important, so I'm going to spend just a few seconds on it. Saint-Simon said that the upheavals of the modern world, meaning republican or democratic thinking, the organization of the masses, the aggressiveness of the masses, that all of this needs firm rule. But you can't just have any old, you know, just can't have politicians rule. So far I agree with it. But instead, he said, this is an age of technical things and technical improvements that come from the Enlightenment, come from the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, and it has to be technical people or technocrats who run society. So, you know, he said that it makes about as much sense for parliaments to meet together and debate the laws as it would make for parliament to meet together and to debate the laws of physics or the laws of astronomy or something. They just don't know anything. And so you have to get rid of the debating societies called parliaments and replace those with just a bunch of technocrats who know their business, who are scientists, engineers, technical people who know how to organize society. And then in the organizer, he also rolls out a view of society that is very close to what we would call a kind of communal, totally run society, totally top-down society, very strong emphasis on engineering, technology, and so forth. Now, I say all this, he was denounced later when Marx and Engels started talking about utopian socialism. He plays a very, very important role in Marxism itself, because Marx's father was a Sansimonian who lived in Trier in the southwestern part of Germany. And Marx's father bequeathed this kind of top-down thinking to Marx himself. Marx then went off to the University of Berlin there to sit under the influence of the German philosopher Hegel, and I didn't write his name down, it's easy to spell, H-E-G-E-L. And it's kind of a combination of radical socialist thinking, Hegelian dialectics, and Sansimonian top-down leadership of the elites theory that really leads to Marx's political theory of the dictatorship of the proletariat, the dialectical procession of history and revolution, and so forth. So Sansimon turns out to be pretty important, even though Marx's crony Engels later denounced him as a utopian. I've wondered what Marx, if he didn't smart at that, if there wasn't some kind of Freudian problem with Engels really doing more, and he did most of the denouncing, I believe. If Marx didn't think, have a little pause over the fact that his father's main political view was being denounced. Well, Marx, as you know, wrote in the middle of the 19th century. So we've got Sansimon in 1814, Marx writing the Communist Manifesto, for example, in 1848. Das Kapital, Capital, comes out 1859, the beginning of it. And so Marx is in the middle of the century. Well, a contemporary of his, an exact contemporary, almost, and also another Sansimonian disciple, Auguste Comte, becomes extremely important for us. Comte takes the idea of the technocracy as the leading element of society and extends it to create a kind of whole view of what's to come. Comte thought, like Sansimon, that society had to be, that people were not able to rule themselves, that the ideal society, and there's a lot of Plato in there too, ideal society should be run by these very educated people. But Comte said, it's not just science, it's not just engineers, it's the science of society. And so in the process, Comte is also inventing the subject of sociology, which he meant to be the science of society, and he meant to be used to run society. He adds an element here. Marx, in a sense, offered Marxism as a surrogate religion. You know, Marxism, he said, was the morphine of the people, the opium of the people. That is, religion was something that just put people to sleep and made them not realize they were so miserable, but it kept them from getting out in the streets to protest. Well, Comte said, in this running of society, what you got to have a religion. You people just can't get along without it. And therefore, Comte spent a great deal of time developing his idea of something that had really had its germ in the French Revolution, the religion of reason. But he calls it the religion of humanity, and it really works as a kind of general, you might say, motivator, a general mobilizer of people. They come to a church that looks a lot like a Roman Catholic church. I mean, he's from France, right? And they come in there. There's no religious symbols per se. There's no miracles per se. There's no Christianity in it. But it is this religion where it's a civic religion. It's they play uplifting music, and you're proud that you're a member of this society, and somebody stands up and gives a sermon about how you should be good, and that all this is sort of confirmed by the sacrifice of the real people who make it all possible, who sacrifice themselves for you, namely the soldiers and the politicians of the society. So this religion of humanity, as compared to Marx's simple denunciation of religion as the opiate of the people, Comte is very proactive here. It wants to supply the real surrogate elements of this. And this is a point we have to deal with when we get to the 20th century. I think it's an important contribution. In a sense, modern totalitarianism derives a lot from Marx, especially as seen through Lenin. But there's a lot of Comte in there, too, that we have to take into account. He's the inventor, pardon me, he's the inventor of what we call the philosophy of positivism. And I won't go into that, but all of this has to do with a positive, knowledgeable, sociological elite that leads the country. And I'm not even looking at the questions in the chat right now, so let me go back to that. Okay. So, you know what? I think I'll take this slide and put it in the next lecture and just do that. It's important. It's really important for us to think about, but I think I will do it there. I had it in the syllabus there, and then I decided to try to slip it in here, but I believe I will not do it. And I'll go pretty fast past these guys. There's a whole anarchist direction, 19th century anarchist, left-wing anarchist direction that we need to take into account. And here I would have this lineup of folks. On the left, Pierre Proudhon, then in the middle, Mikhail Bakunin, and on the right, Georges Sorel. Proudhon is Sorel, a Frenchman, Bakunin's a Russian. And Proudhon is the real founder of modern left-wing anarchism. He wrote What is Property, Qu'est-ce que la propriété, in 1840, and his answer to what is property was, it's theft. He denounced the state as a bad thing, so far so good, possibly. And his solution to it was a sort of ground up society, meaning working from the ground up, not that it was ground up, but a kind of society that was built from the bottom up, and that really where people made their own decisions. In actuality, though, when you got right down to it, both he and the Russian, his follower, the Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, said, "Well, you got to have leadership here. You can't just do it without leadership, and we need to establish sort of national, for any given area, regional or national norms to coordinate these decisions." So they hadn't really figured out how to run an anarchy without property on any kind of basis, because and in the first place somebody had to kill all the property owners to do it. The next person there, Georges Sorel, I think is very important. He's a French a political thinker of the left, who wrote his famous book Reflections on Violence in 1912. He was of the anarchist persuasion in that he was from the syndicalist variety. It was a part of the socialist movement, the labor movement, that was very closely aligned with the anarchists in many cases. And the syndicalists were those people who wanted to create a general strike and then bring down society so that all the anarchist stuff could start. So Grail was a syndicalist. There were sometimes called anarcho-syndicalists. And he wrote a book in which he said, you know, here's the thing. Bourgeois society has us fooled into thinking that violence is a bad thing. But actually, for us materialists, atheists, leftists, we've got to see that violence is a good thing. If somebody dies through our violence, he said, then that's for the greater good. And so therefore, you have to do some violence to get rid of the old order, the old structures, the old governments, and so forth. You have to do that. And if you do that, then it's good. So violence can be a good creative thing. He talked about the creative, freshening elements of violence. That's important, too. I mean, it is all these anarchists who were assassinating folks around the end of the 19th century, and that's the direction they come from. And I mention them especially because there is this kind of wild left-wing element in all of the totalitarian movements, including the Nazi movement. We'll have to get to that, but including the Nazi movement, including the fascist movement, and indeed, Mussolini was, in fact, an anarcho-syndicalist before he made his great conversion in 1914 to become a nationalist socialist. But so these guys are important. Sorel, very, very important in particular, and we'll have to talk more about him. What Lenin does for us in terms of totalitarianism is to put a lot of these things together, plus more. Lenin was born into a Russia that was in the throes of a social sea change under Alexander II, the great Tsar reformer. Lenin's brother was involved with revolutionaries who were hunted down by the Tsar's secret police. One thing I'm going to say about Russia when we talk about Russia is that there's a certain Russian part of all this totalitarian thinking that really does come into Europe, into the rest of Europe from Russia and its tradition. And Lenin, whose name was not Lenin originally, but Ulyanov, this was his nom de guerre as a communist, but or as a Bolshevik, but he managed to put a lot of things together. I think that was his genius, that he started with Marxism, but made all these additions that made it, that kind of filled in the blanks that Marx had left in terms of gaining power, keeping power. Do I think that either one of them was, in a sense, totally sincere when these had to be, when their movement was called a workers' movement? Were they just genuinely working for the betterment of the workers? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they thought. Lenin himself devoted a large part of his life to this, and I don't think it was just to gain personal power. I do think that he had convinced himself in some ways that that he was doing, you know, the masses good. But in the convoluted ways that his theory worked, it's kind of hard to tell. Whatever his motivation, Lenin invents all the, he lays out all the bases of the modern totalitarian trends and kind of weaves them together. You know, once the Bolsheviks took over after November 1917, it's even Lenin who sits there in one of the very first Council of Commissars meetings and says, you know, we've got to borrow from whom we can borrow from. And since we don't know how to construct a Marxist-Leninist or Marxist economy, we have to borrow from the Germans who have just instituted, in the midst of World War I, instituted total control through the means of something called the Hindenburg Plan. And so Hindenburg and Ludendorff, he said, are the guys who have kind of worked this out for us, and we'll just follow them. And so there's the origin of his famous war communism, which became sort of, to date, from everything that we reviewed, the thing that looked most like a complete totalitarian state, and indeed it was. It was really the first of the totalitarian totalitarian states. And the let me mention this really quickly. This is another important influence on totalitarianism, and it's just undeniable that the imperialism, the new imperialism of the world, is out this scramble for Africa in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. The taking of all the island real estate and the domination of China and all of that, that the domination of the Philippines by the United States, all these things led to concentration camps, the use of barbed wire. I just mentioned barbed wire there. The whole idea of top-down social planning and the kind of uses of Comtean planning, this is all very, very important, because these imperial habits where we're ruling some lesser race, as all these imperialists said they were doing, helping their little brown brothers, as they said, in these horrible wars of conquest where they ended up killing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. But in all these cases, they said, well, we're doing them such good, and we got to run their lives. And then they brought back those elements. It's blowback, right? They brought back this imperialism to their home countries. So by the time we get past 1900, there's an awful lot of that kind of total war thinking, that kind of growth of government, that kind of top-down decision-making in society, in European societies and all Western societies. The American progressives are just one example of that. That was the case in Germany and the case in Britain and France and elsewhere. So they invent, in this period before World War I, the concentration camp. And you've got to admit, without the concentration camp, you just really can't have a good, thoroughgoing totalitarian state. You've got to have it. And without barbed wire, which was invented for the use of cattle in the 1870s, without the barbed wire to make the concentration camp, you can't afford to really do that. So these are important kinds of things. If you want to know some writings on all this, just ask me and I will tell you. But this is where research is going. There are some imperialistic elements here. I mean, within an empire, when you're dealing with this lesser people and that lesser people, the individual just disappears, and you start doing the kind of simplifying that José Ortega y Gasset called this terrible simplifying, where you just reduce people to a kind of formula, and then eventually, you know, if you need to move them or kill them or whatever, expropriate them, then you just do it. In the end, though, after all is said and done, it takes a war to do all this. It takes a war to create totalitarianism. I'm sure many of you have read Robert Higgs's classics, one of the great works of American historiography, of American history. It's called A Crisis and Leviathan, and it's about the ways in which crisis in the course of American history from the 19th century to the 20th century inflicted more and more of the state. And this process that he talks about, whereby it's a crisis that takes us to the next level. Well, this ultimate crisis of World War I from 1914 to 1918 provided precisely that kind of thing for all the participants involved, and it's really the basis for totalitarianism. You think about it, the Bolsheviks come about during the war. Hitler's in the war and joins the Nazi party, this fledgling little party of crackpots, 1919, just after the war. Mussolini is there at home, plumping for more war, and immediately after the war starts the first fascio di combattimento of the fascist movement, and so forth and so on. So it's this war. It really takes a war to do it. The dehumanization of the war, the horrific pressures of the war to say, well, you see, to solve this, we've got to do something radical, and that radical thing is to take over. By the way, that picture on the lower right, that painting is a French painting from 1917 by Henri Leroux, and it's called Hell. And so it took a kind of hell to create the circumstances for all this, and well, we had it in the form of the Great War. So that is our lecture for today, and I will now move from the lecture part to the question and answer part. Let me just explain very briefly how the syllabus works. You go to it online, and you see what's to be read. It's on the right hand side of your screen when you're on Moodle, or there's a complete edition of it under another section. I forget, is it called New Reports? I forget. You'll find it. I mean, the site is easily navigable. But what you do is just simply whatever is listed for the day, you read that for the day. So, for example, in this coming week, it's the first couple of sections. They're long sections, too, of omnipotent government. Again, you can read it online or print out the parts you want or whatever you want to do. Everything's online. And then I'll talk about it for much less of the time next time. Because what I want to do next time is really to let you kind of get involved in the analysis of it, and we'll use this whole chat function to make this all work out. So I will certainly lecture, talk about some more background things, some of the historical references that Mises makes in the book may be obscure to you, and I will explain all of those either in the lecture or in the question and answer. So I think that'll be a good session. It'll be fun and a change of pace from this sort of big mega historical rundown. Okay. Well, let me ask you now, if you've got questions, feel free to put them on the chat line. I'm switched over to that. I can see what you're saying, and just ask them. Or is there, what about that question and Q&A? Ah. You know what? There's questions here already. Let me start with these, okay? Is it just those two? I believe it's just the two. Okay. Leslie Webb, hello, asks, to what extent did the vast inflow of specie from the New World in the 16th century contribute to the rise of absolutist regimes in Europe? Well, that's an interesting question, and I'll say this. I don't think it's a closed question. There's still some research on that. Some Austrian economic scholars are working on some of the technical aspects of that. And I'll say this. I mean, it led to that inflow of gold and silver led to a kind of inflation in the New World. I mean, it's certainly the specie coming in helped Spain field all these standing armies, and in a sense, this triggered the desire in everybody else to field the standing armies. And so, for example, when the Spanish become so rich that they can arm the Armada, then and even before 1588, they have that potential to, you know, create a big fleet to attack England. And so this is what makes it, this is what pushes Henry VIII to smash the church, to take over the church, so that he will have enough resources to counter, in some way, some future predators. So in a way, it does get to be a competition and a kind of, ratcheting up of the power. So to that extent, I mean, in that way, certainly the inflow of specie was important. Also, these regimes, as I mentioned from the beginning, were into the manipulation of currency, and the Spanish monarchy was into that. Although I will say that it's within the Habsburg Spanish monarchy, and that a number of scholars first analyzed the whole problem of inflation and the manipulation of currency, and analyzed it also in the terms of justice and what was just and what was right. So, it's an interesting question. It certainly is involved. And Charles Haynes says, what about Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism? How does that work intersect with what we're talking about? Well, it intersects directly. We're going to talk about her in a couple of classes and her analysis of it. And, Arendt, yeah, it's the same pronunciation no matter how you spell it, Arendt. So, we will certainly talk about that, Charles. No, and you'll see when we get there. Any other questions? I'm sure there are other questions. I'll just be patient. Let me check the chat list. I'm not sure whether you're putting them on the question and answer one or another one, but you're welcome, Charles. Ask anything you like. This is the part that takes a little bit of getting used to, but it's also the fun part too. So Lee Cape up on the chat section asks, how did the Roman Empire differ from the Machiavellian state? Well, it's really interesting. I mean, it's significant that Machiavelli chose this word state, or it's an Italian word, il stato, that comes from the Latin past participle status. And those of you who are Latin scholars among the class, I'm sure you know already, you're already chuckling about this. Status is the past participle of to stand, okay? So sto stare, stati, status means something that is standing, something that has stood, something that exists. So he uses a different abstract term. And I think that's a very interesting choice. And he uses it over and over and over again, and even begins to, I mean, this abstract term in the course of the book, and this is one of the interesting things to me, it becomes real for him. And so he starts talking about, well, why would this monarch want to not be a Christian monarch or not worry about Christian morals? And his answer is reasons of state. We know this phrase from French, raison d'état in modern lingo. But I mean, Machiavelli's saying this in Italian, and he's saying it's the reasons of this state, the way things are. So he's got a very abstract interpretation. Well, the Romans used an abstract word too, res publica, meaning the public thing, which on the surface is very similar. But I think Machiavelli was careful not to say it. I think the Romans had a for all their problems with freedom, and I don't think the Roman Empire was any great exemplar of freedom. But the Romans did at least recognize from the outset, from the time of the Law of the Twelve Tables in the early days of the Republic, the Romans recognized law as a kind of contract. Now they often observed the law in the breaching of it, but still in all, it was a place where there was a kind of legality that was overall. In fact, the Romans differentiated between the local laws that they really let remain in place. For example, in Judea or in Syria or in Greece, they let local law bodies remain in place, and then there's this overlay of the Roman administration. But that's just specific law. That's just a local law. But they also said there's a law that goes everywhere, lex nationis. That's the law of nations, and that spreads all over the place. And And we recognize that there are some universal principles here. I mean, they weren't speaking really of ways to manipulate people with law. They were really thinking about it as a kind of contract. So there is that within the Roman Empire. Whereas in the case, Machiavelli, he's talking about a single, centralized, unified law. The law has to go out from the king. It has to be the king's law and not any kind of local thing. So there's a couple of differences there. And of course, we can talk about many more. And again, there's technology. In a way, the Romans had better transportation than many parts of Europe in the time of Machiavelli. But we'll talk about that. We can talk about that if you want to some other time. Any other questions? Let's see. I'll go back to, looks like Danny's comment on the French Revolutionary government. I think this is also true. It's whereas a lot of people think of total wars in terms of the American Civil War or the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71, Danny's right on the money when he says that the first total war is really the French Revolutionary Wars, because they carried out this levée en masse, the mass raising of troops, and the principle behind that raising of troops didn't mean that they took everybody, but they just said the principle was everybody owes their life to the country. Basically, that's the addition of the nation part to the state. In other words, the French Revolution added to this invention of the state, added the nation. And so that's where we get this kind of nation state. And part of the ideology of the nation is you are born into the nation, therefore you owe your birth to it. You owe your birth, you owe your life to it. And therefore the levée en masse said that we're all, you know, it said men are obligated to go. Old men, women, and children, well, they can do other warlike things. Everybody's obligated. It's not just some warrior class. It's all classes. Not just a peasant class. It's all classes. So that's very true. Let's see how we're doing on the question answer. Charles, I don't think the conflict with Carthage was an example of totalitarianism. I think the Roman Empire differed in many essentials from modern totalitarianism. I think that the vast majority of people, if they kind of kept their nose clean and kind of minded their own business, I think that those people just lived out their lives. I don't think there was anything like the intervention into their lives of later regimes. So that would be my answer to that. Well, I mean, Carthage, I see your second question there, your addition. We've all heard about the Latin phrase Cartago delenda est, and Carthage was, in fact, the first destroyed its political. Yeah, I mean, it was certainly destroyed. I mean, these were brutal wars for sure, and they were wars of aggression and wars of, you know, whatever you want to call them. But I don't... First of all, they weren't people's wars, which totalitarian wars really have to be. So the mass of the people were not in any way engaged, even though it was a slave society. So, yeah, I just think it's a very different kind of case. I would argue that that 20th century totalitarianism is really sui generis, that it's not, that it really hasn't happened before. You got bits and pieces and this and that happening, but I think it's a different thing. And we'll be talking a lot more about that. How did 19th century anarchists differ from classical liberals? I think they perceived each other as differing completely. I do. I think that classical liberals, almost none of them, really rejected the very state itself. I thought they thought it had become crooked and plundered people, but most of them thought that if you could limit the powers of the government to plunder in Bastiat's century. And if you could limit the plunder of the government, that you could get along pretty well. That, or any regime's okay, the liberals thought, as long as there's not too much of it. But that's the key thing, that it would be okay. I mean, they didn't mind, most liberals didn't mind monarchy at all. You know, most English liberals, they were pretty well okay with the crown. It was actually the parliament they thought was taking more power. So they didn't like the power of the state, but in a way they were quite practical, because, you know, they looked around and said the state's not about to fall, but, you know, if you just limit it, we're okay. Whereas the left-wing anarchists did use a radical analysis and say the state has to go. I mean, by any means, anytime you can hack away at it. So that's a huge difference. The 19th century anarchists were all socialists. They were all collectivists. They were all practically to a person. They were practically all materialists, and by that I mean atheists or somebody in that neck of the woods from the standpoint of religion. They were almost all anti-clerical, against the power of the established churches and so forth. Whereas when we talk about the liberals, some of them were somewhat anti-clerical, but frankly, you could be quite liberal and still be an adherent. In fact, in many cases, that people were liberals because they were adherents to a church. I think of I'm blocking a name. I've said too many names today. Now I've run out of brain power. The power corrupts and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. Who am I thinking of? Somebody can say it right quick. But Lord Acton, thank you. So, Acton himself is a great, great classical liberal thinker and this wonderful, hero and all that. But you see, he's religious, where you don't have any anarchists. I mean, there's a Christian socialist movement that partly leads into Marx's first International Workingmen's Association. But there's nothing like an Acton on that side. Let's see, what do we got here? And from John Jones, coming at us from Texas also. There's one up above, I missed it. Was it the non-aggression principle? I'm sorry, Lee, I don't understand your question. You mean, is that how they differed? I don't think so. But, I mean, maybe. I mean, certainly the liberals tended to, yeah, I guess so. I mean, if I'm trying to translate what you're saying to those conditions, and I guess if you're saying that were classical liberals, you know, in general, non-violent and kind of like, you know, John Stuart Mill thing, you know, my rights begin, end where your nose begins. So, yeah, I guess so. I guess, yeah, I can see that. That makes sense. Because certainly the anarchists not only didn't mind violence against other people, but they advocated it. They were strong opponents to it, and they liked to assassinate people. And in fact, there's a whole direction there. I didn't mention this when we were talking about the anarcho-syndicalist movement. But, you know, there's a theory that actually comes out of the Russian social upheavals of under Alexander II in the 1860s, 1870s, that really is a death movement. And it's about, it's an argument, okay, how do you overthrow all of society? And the answer is, you kill all the leaders. You just kill so many of the elites that basically it falls down of its own weight. And so there is this part too. There's that becomes a part of the anarchist tradition. That's why so many people are getting assassinated. They're saying, if we can just assassinate the American president and the French prime minister and the wife of the French defense minister and the Empress of Austria and all these different people. I mean, they take them one by one, of course. But if we can just assassinate all these people, then basically the system will fall apart. So yeah, that's that violent, yeah, non-aggression principle indeed. So yeah, that's I go along with you on that. And let me move down then to the next one that I see on there, which is Leslie Webb's question, can you say something about Napoleon's role in the rise of totalitarianism? It's ambiguous. There's a little on both sides. Napoleon was, in a sense, a successor of Rousseau and Robespierre, in that he too used this kind of, in fact he was a Robespierreist when he was a young man. He's barely escaped the the reaction against Robespierre, and he almost joined him on the scaffold himself. But so he was a kind of Robespierreist in a way, but much more calm about it, much less devoted. Napoleon, he thought of himself as the voice of the people, and, you know, he set up this plebiscitary way of ruling. So every one of his big measures, he'd hold a big national plebiscite. And, of course, there was corruption, and they jacked the vote around and all that. But still in all, the theory was that he was the voice of the people. But it's also true that in terms of law, I mean, he had a great respect for law, and he himself helped very materially, was on the committee that created the Code Napoleon, the Napoleonic Law Code, the Code Napoleon. And also, he's just not, I mean, we get our ideas about Napoleon mainly from British propaganda, and you know, in the whole time of Napoleon, there's so few people who are even in prison. You know, there's a few liberal thinkers who clash with him, and they're condemned to the horrible, horrible fate of having to leave France, you know, which, well, frankly, probably is a horrible fate, but it's not like they're going to the Gulag Archipelago, okay? So, in a way, there's a big difference. I mean, there's one of the great crimes of Napoleon, if you really get down to it, if you really read, you know, what he's being accused of, one of the great crimes is that there's an emigre French nobleman, and he sent people and had him assassinated because of some things he had done and things he had said. Well, you know, it's wrong, but really, compared to Hitler or Stalin or Mao or Pol Pot or Castro or any of them, I mean, you know, what is that? There's some elements that I'd say yes, and some elements I'd say no. Hope that answers your question. Revolution of 1848. Well, most of the revolutions of 1848 they all started with some kind of social revolution. They ended up as national revolutions for nationalism. But they did spawn this atmosphere of people trying to find out solutions to this revolutionary problem. In a way, this is what Comte and Saint-Simon were trying to do. They thought, this is a century of upheavals, and therefore, what's the solution to that? Well, it's this kind of total government. And so 1848 was certainly another one of those kinds of things. And there were socialist parties, you know, the very first radical phase of the French 1848 revolution, Louis Blanc, the socialist, was in the cabinet, and they set up these national workshops and these little socialist schemes. So, but it wasn't a very totalitarian. I mean, the real totalitarianism came when the commune took back over and set up a kind of a horrific workers' regime, and there was street fighting in Paris. But so insofar, there's some influence there. It's certainly a part of the history of it. But it really did get Marx fired up. You know, it's in this atmosphere that he writes the manifesto, and then he rushed to Paris to take part in the revolution, and it's in this atmosphere that so many of these thinkers pushed for, Proudhon, all the rest of them thought, revolution was about to come. So a lot of this wave of socialist left-wing writing and collectivist writing came about in this period, partly because, not because the revolutions were going in that direction, but because it kind of buoyed them up and they were enthusiastic for one. How could anarchists be anarchist and collectivist at the same time? Well, anarchism was not about individualism in any sense. Proudhon's anarchism suggested that people organize and that you have a kind of, it's almost like a kind of democratic dictatorship at each level of society, that, this is all organized from the ground up, but it is organized, so it's not like individuals deciding anything. It's always a group decision, so it's totally collectivistic, even though he's envisioning the collectivism as bubbling up and being bottom-up collectivism rather than top-down collectivism. So I don't know if that's easy or hard for them to reconcile that, but that's certainly what they did. So Proudhon, Bakunin, all of them were of that persuasion. Let's see. How deeply do you think American progressive thinkers were influenced by Marxism? You know, that's a good question. That's a good thought. They were certainly influenced by him. I mean, they were thinking about socialism. They all knew about Marx. Woodrow Wilson is writing in his diary and his notes in the 1880s. Well, it's clear to me that democracy is socialism, and socialism is democracy, and that's what we have to work toward. And so, in that general sense, I think a lot of them were influenced in a general way by Marx. But I do think this. I think Comte takes first place, and I think Marx is way behind him in the thinking of the progressives. Comte is. It's an American positivist, a Comtean, who's the creator of the Pledge of Allegiance, and you've read the early versions of that, and you've seen that in the original version of it, they wanted to have a kind of a Heil at the end of it, you've seen that probably on Wikipedia, but that's all kind of Comtean. That's part of this civic religion type thing. So I think the positivists were certainly they had the same influences, but they're more filtered through Comte than through Marx. That's what I would say about that. It's a good question. Let's see. I guess we're nearly about to run out of time here. I don't know how many folks we still have. 14 left. Any more questions? Because I can take a few more, and then I think I better, I was going to say end it all, but I don't mean to end it all. I just mean to end the session, end all the good questions and everything. So anybody got anything else? Let's see if one comes through from Lee. Did Pump directly influence any prominent, directly in the sense that you mean they read his writings? Yeah, many. Wilson among them. On this score, you ought to get if you're close to a good library or interlibrary loan situation. I don't know how you could pick this up, but there's a book written about 15 years ago by an American, a really fine American historian, a historian of the U.S. and East American, too. Named Gillis Harp, H-A-R-P, and I'm kind of blocking the actual title, but it's about positivism, early American positivism, Comtean morality, and so forth, and the extent to which so many of these, so much of the Comtean view was kind of built into a whole movement of associations. There's a lot of social Darwinism in there too. that kind of got mixed together into this mix. So yeah, it's pretty directed. But Gillis, that's G-I-L-L-I-S, Harp, H-A-R-P. Who also happens to be a really good friend of mine, and is a very, very fine writer. It's a great book. But it will tell you, and you know, the funny thing is, in that book, Gillis, he's not necessarily a libertarian. He's a fine guy and all that, but he's not necessarily a libertarian. At the time he wrote that book, you can see this grudging admiration, because there's such a fervent kind of spirit to all these sort of civic humanitarians, so to speak. Thank you very much, Charles. That is the title. And you know, I think we should let this be it's a good end to the course. We got plenty to talk about throughout this whole course. Let's just say that's it. And Danny, I'll thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it. Yeah, excellent. Thanks, Charles. Very good. And Danny, if you'll tell me how to, I don't see right off the bat how to sign off. Thank you very much, Lee and Charles John. Very good. Excellent. Thank you. Very good. Very good. Russell and Leslie, thank you. Totalitarian joke. Yeah, I'll put it on. I'll do that. And I see that you'd like to take it to credit. That's excellent. I will. You'll see the assignments and everything online. Okay, folks, well, I think I'll just unconnect now, and that'll be it, if I can do that.